You're listening to DTFHN for August 29th, 2026. I'm your 90 years and still running host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News. A website W section performs unpaid peer review on everything you've ever loved. Today is about the things that outlast the people who built them and who gets to hold the key. Boilers hot. Let's go. What does it mean to put the thinking inside the remembering? That sounds abstract, but Samsung showed something at Hot Chips 2026 that makes it concrete. They're building multiply cumulate units, the arithmetic engine of every neural network, directly inside LPDDR Viam's memory chips. 16 banks, 16 little compute blocks, one per bank. The reason this matters is a bandwidth wall. Inside a DRAM chip, all 16 banks together can move about 614 gigabytes per second. But the pipe out of the chip? 76.8. Almost all of that internal bandwidth has never been usable because it can't fit through the door. Samsung's move is to stop trying to get the data out and instead move the math in. The engineering here is genuinely elegant. They kept the standard LPDDR5X protocol completely intact. No new interface, no exotic memory controller. Instead, they reserve special row addresses that behave like control registers. Activate one row, the chip flips into multi-bank mode. Activate another, and reads and writes start hitting PIM registers instead of DRAM contents. You load your model weights normally, then flip a switch made of addresses, and suddenly, your memory is doing inference. That's a beautiful hack. Now the due diligence. The raw number is 2.4 TOPS per package. 8 chips gets you roughly the equivalent of the neural engine in Intel's Meteor Lake, while requiring 128 gigabytes of memory to get there, and the sharpest reader comment cuts right to the limit. Each PIM block only has fast access to its own bank. Everything else still crawls through that same narrow external interface. Matrix multiplication needs every element to meet every other element. Locality is the whole game. And this architecture gives you locality only within 1/16th of the chip. Another commenter made the observation I keep turning over. Instead of putting more cache on the CPU, you put the CPU on the cache. And someone else noted this rhymes with ISA extended memory cards from the 1980s, some of which shipped with their own processor. Computing keeps rediscovering the same shape. The open-close question is where this gets serious. This is a memory standard, JEDEC-governed, multi-vendor, the most commoditized layer in the entire stack. If in-memory compute arrives as a published extension, every vendor implements it and every inference framework targets it. If it arrives as a Samsung-only side channel, accessed through magic row addresses that only Samsung's driver knows about, then the most fungible component in your machine just became a vendor lock. Same silicon, entirely different future. Architecture decides. So we've got silicon arguing about its own future, but what happens when a machine's future already arrived 90 years ago and it just kept running? Story 2. I have a soft spot for systems that keep running past the point anyone planned for. Every deployment I've been part of has a component nobody wants to touch. The thing that works, that predates the current architecture, that would take 6 months to replace, and nobody can articulate why you'd bother. Usually it's a scheduler. In Wolsten, Poland, it's a steam locomotive. The PT-47-Knight, Monday through Friday, Wolsten, to the Bosnik. Saturdays, it runs to Poznan. This is not a heritage excursion. You buy the ticket through Koleje Wielkopolski, the same regional operator that sells you a seat on anything else, or from the conductor if you're late. The class was built between 1948 and 1951. largely at Segelski in Poznan, which is roughly 40 kilometers from where the thing still reports for work. Britain ended mainline steam on the 11th of August, 1968. The 15 Guinea special, Liverpool to Carlisle and back, a farewell tour with a ceremony attached. Wolston never held the ceremony, the depot just kept firing the boiler, and the timetable kept listing the departure. And now the absence of decision has outlasted every railway that made one. The detail that gets me is the notice at the top of the page, kite. From the 20th to the 28th of August, the PT-4765 is out for periodic inspection, so service runs behind an SM-42 diesel instead. A 78-year-old steam locomotive is described in the same bureaucratic register as a bus in the shop. Substitute traction. Back next week. And one commenter noticed that the national ticketing site, which will happily sell you passage on this train, has no graphic for a steam locomotive, so it renders an electric multiple unit. The database schema simply does not contain the category. The train exists, the icon does not. Here's what I find genuinely beautiful about it. The PT-47 is a completely legible machine. Every dimension is on a drawing. Every part can be made on a lathe by someone with a manual. And the failure modes are visible, audible, and hot. Nothing in it phones home. Nothing expires. The reason it's still moving passengers in 2026 is that its entire design is inspectable by the people who maintain it, which is the same property that keeps any system alive long after its vendors stops caring. One commander rode a coal-fired train in Kozelin and got soot in their lungs, and that's fair. Legible does not mean clean, but it does mean repairable, and repairable is why it's still here. Moving on. Every action reachable by pointer should be reachable by key. That's not a hot take from a blog. It's written into the GNOME Human Interface Guidelines, and versions of it live in Apple's and Microsoft's docs too, which raises an awkward question. If the rule is documented, endorsed, and decades old, why does an entire debate about terminal interfaces rest on pretending it doesn't exist? Cardaris takes on a specific claim that terminal UIs are better because they're keyboard-driven and the counter's precise. Keyboard-driven isn't a property of terminals. It's a property of the constraint terminals impose on developers. A TUI has no pointer to fall back on, so the developer must wire every action to a key. Remove the constraint, and most developers stop doing the work. The keyboard support was never a design philosophy. It was a side effect of not having a mouse. Follow that to the end, and the pro-TUI argument eats itself. If keyboard access is the actual goal, you don't want a terminal. You want a graphical framework where the developer bothered, because a GUI can do things a terminal structurally cannot. Real focus rings, screen reader integration, discoverable shortcut menus, rebindable key maps with visual feedback. The superset argument holds. The execution is what's missing. And this is where the accessibility folks in the thread cut through everything. One commenter who does compliance work said, put on headphones, turn on the OS voice assistant, wear blinders, and use your app with only a keyboard. That's not a power user exercise. That's how some people use every computer they touch every day. Keyboard navigation and screen reader support are the same engineering problem wearing two hats. Build one and you have mostly built the other. Someone else pointed out that in Windows 3.1, it was nearly impossible to ship a program that wasn't fully keyboard navigable. The platform enforced it. We didn't discover a better way, we just stopped enforcing the old one and called the result progress. The fix is unglamorous and available right now. Cardaris built Khaleesi, his first GUI application, and wired shortcuts to the full range of actions because he decided to. That's the whole mechanism. It's not framework limitation. It's not budget. It's not hard. It's a few afternoons of tab order work that makes your software usable by people who couldn't touch it before. The guidelines already say to do it. Go read them, then go do it. So what happens when accessibility isn't the problem, when the software works fine until you run it on a 32-bit chip and the runtime itself starts lying to you? Two comments on this story, and one of them is a shrug. I wonder what other 32-bit bugs are waiting to be discovered. That's the whole thread, basically. A crash report that sat in the Go issue tracker since March 2025, with multiple reporters, a rejected fix attempt, and no resolution. Then a consultancy at SigmaStar picked it up because a customer's embedded device kept falling over. The error is beautiful in its specificity. Go's runtime prints, netpoll eventfd, ready for 5.5 is epaulin or epaulin. The runtime asked epaul to watch for readable only, and epaul came back saying readable and writable. That assertion has been true for years on x86 4 and ARM 64. Never once did it fail there. Only 32-bit ARM and i386, only on processes that had been running a long time. Here's the craft I admire. The first instinct is that Apple behaves differently on 32-bit. They killed that theory immediately. Apple is generic kernel code. There's no architecture-specific path. That's the discipline that separates a real debugging session from flailing. You eliminate the explanation that would be convenient. So, they went to the data field. A poll lets you stash an 8-byte cookie alongside each watch descriptor, and Go uses it to tell its internal event file descriptor apart from socket descriptors. The check is a pointer comparison. Dereference the address of ev.data as a pointer to pointer to ompa and see if it equals the address of the event fd object. 8 bytes of kernel cookie. 4-byte pointers. And a tag field, fdac. A counter writing in the upper bits to distinguish recycled socket objects. Now hold those three facts together. Like care, the Kneading Desert wouldn't go quishing. You waddly is in tease also rove. And the shape of the bug appears before you've read another line. Long running process. Counter grow. Something bleeds across a boundary that only exists when your pointers are half the width the code assumes. The reason this got fixed is that the code was readable. Anyone with the itch could open netpoll_epaul.go and follow the pointer arithmetic. The runtime of a language used by half the infrastructure on Earth, and a consultancy debugging a customer's router could just go look. That's not a small thing. That's the ladder staying down. That's the thing about readable code. You can just go look. Now, someone booted an actual iPhone inside a virtual machine on their Mac. Story 5. 113 binary patches. That's the jailbreak variant. The experimental one runs 141. And among them are patches specifically designed to defeat anti-VM detection. So the guest can't tell it's a guest. Here's what's actually being virtualized. Not an emulator. Not Corellium re-implementing silicon in software. Apple ships an iOS kernel inside the Cloud OS images that back private cloud compute. The research VM infrastructure they publish so security people could audit their inference servers. That kernel already knows how to boot under virtualization.framework. This project, from a developer named Locker, takes that kernel and pairs it with the iOS user space from a regular iPhone IPSW. Download, merge, patch the boot chain, DFU, restore, install the custom firmware, boot. One command, then you SSH into your iPhone on port 22222. Username mobile, password Alpine. Celeo and Troll Store install themselves on first boot. VNC to see the screen. A commenter asks the obvious question, how is this different from the simulator? The simulator is a translation layer. Your app compiled for the host, running against a shim. This is the actual ARM64 kernel, the actual user space, the actual security architecture, with AmFi and SSV and TXM bypassed by name in a documented patch table. There's a file in the repo, 0_binary_patch_comparison, that breaks down what each variant disables per component. Run this forward, another commenter mentions VPhone MCP, a bridge that lets an agent drive the VM, take screenshots, navigate the interface. Combine those two facts, disposable iPhones cloned in seconds via APFS, each with a fresh device identity, controlled programmatically. Test matrices that used to require a drawer full of hardware become a for loop. Security research that required physical devices and a signed Bootrom exploit becomes a config flag. The infrastructure that makes this possible exists because Apple wanted to prove private cloud compute was trustworthy. They opened the door a crack for auditors, and someone walked through it carrying an entire phone. That's the pattern worth noticing. Every artifact published for verification becomes a substrate for building. Apple's transparency commitment on PCC was sincere. And the second order effect is a homebrew formula that boots a jailbroken iPhone on your desktop. The prerequisites list is honest about the cost. SIPNAMFI relaxation, private entitlements, unsign the binaries. You are trading the host guarantees for the gas freedom. That's the deal, stated plainly. Storage layer next. What happens when someone applies that same obsessive engineering to the humble key value store? Story 6, Turbo KV. The first commits were about the logo. That's the detail a reader flagged with a laugh, and it's the one worth sitting with. Before the write-ahead log, before the memtable, before a single bloom filter got persisted. Somebody drew a picture. That's not a joke about priorities. That's what it looks like when a person decides a thing is going to exist and be seen. Strip the storage engine down to first principles, and there are only three real constraints. Where does a write live when you acknowledge it? How do you find a key without reading everything? How do you reclaim space without stopping the world? Turbo KV answers all three. In Rust, async, embedded. The durability presets are where the honesty lives. Three modes. Fast means in-memory visibility. No write-ahead log at all. Durable appends to the log without a per-write sync. Paranoid waits for a group sync all to actually complete before your call returns. A commenter pushed back. Durable that doesn't FineMake isn't really durable. It survives a process crash, but not a power cut. That's a fair correction. And the table already says it in plain language. Appended to the wall without a per-write sync. The naming oversells. The documentation doesn't. The build instructions carry the other tell. The persisted bloom filter format uses hardware AES, so you compile x86 with target feature plus AES plus SSSE2. ARM with plus AES plus N-E-O-N. That's someone reaching for the AES round instruction as a fast mixing primitive, because modern CPUs give you that for free in silicon. It's a real engineering choice with a real cost. Your on-disk format now depends on an instruction set. And the README tells you exactly what to type instead of letting you discover it in a segful, 64 MB memtable, 64 MB block cache, LZ4 by default. One open handle exclusively owns its directory, and dropping that handle is explicitly not a clean shutdown contract. These are the sentences of somebody who has debugged the failure. Somebody asked how it compares to RocksDB. Reasonable question, wrong frame. RocksDB is a decade of Facebook engineering. This is version 0.6. On GitHub, MIT adjacent, and readable end-to-end. You can open the compaction loop and understand it in an afternoon. Every programmer eventually writes their own database. Good. That's how the next generation of them gets built. So if a database's 600 lines can make you smile, what happens when someone does the same thing to the front end? Story 7. The strongest case against HTMX4 comes from a working engineer, and it's in the comments. Someone who builds .netap is with Angular front ends, says HTMX made their work harder. It forced them back into mixing presentation with data, blurring a boundary they'd spent years keeping clean. That's not a troll. That's the standard architectural argument for the JSON API plus client framework, and it has real merit. Separate your data layer from your view layer. Serve one API to a web app, a mobile app, a partner integration. Discipline through decoupling. Here's where the argument fails on its own terms. It assumes the boundary you drew is the boundary that matters. Consider the human spine. It separates cleanly into vertebrae. Discrete, modular, individually replaceable in principle, but the spinal cord runs continuously through all of them. The modularity is real at one layer and a fiction at another. And a surgeon who treats the vertebrae as independent units kills the patient. JSON AP is draw the vertebrae. The rendering logic. What this data means to a person looking at it. Runs continuously through the whole thing anyway. You didn't eliminate it. You duplicated it once on the server and once in the client. And now you maintain two copies that drift. HTMX4 is 8 months of work by four people, and its headline changes are all subtraction. Attribute inheritance is now explicit. You write HX confirm colon inherited instead of getting inheritance for free. The team says outright that implicit inheritance came from CSS and worked out about like CSS powerful and hard to reason about. Events got standardized into a face colon action shape. History support dropped local storage because it caused support headaches. The XML HTTP person request internals moved to fetch. And the release note contains one line that deserves attention. They are not marking 4.0 as latest on NPM. Users pointing at unversioned CDN URLs would get force upgraded. So 2.x stays latest until early 2027. A team with no growth metric to hit, no quarterly release pressure, choosing 18 months of restraint so nobody's site breaks overnight. They use the phrase 100-year web services. That's the actual disagreement with the Angular position. Not which architecture is cleaner, but what time scale you're optimizing for. The commoner stack is correct for a 5-year product. HTMX is building for the one still running when the framework is gone. That 100-year framing is going to come in handy right now. Story 8, the U.S. sanctions against the AI collective. And what a group builds when it plans past the paperwork. October 2004. Two servers walk out of a Rackspace facility in London, handed to American agents under a mutual legal assistance request nobody would explain. 20-odd indie media sites went dark in a weekend. The stated reason never really arrived. The drives came back, and the lesson movement took away was blunt. If your publishing lives on someone else's iron, your publishing lives at someone else's discretion. The people who took that lesson hardest had already built their answer. AI, Audastici/Inventati, came together in 2001 around a server they named Paranoia. Named it before Genoa, Then the G8 arrived in Genoa, and the media center they helped wire became one of the more consequential rooms in European activist history. 24 years later, they are still volunteers, still free, still funded entirely by donations, still processing every single account request by hand, in conversation, and then destroying the record of it. That's the entity now under U.S. sanctions. Autostici.org is down. Noblogs is partly dysfunctional. Let me argue the other side, because someone should. There's a coherent case that infrastructure isn't neutral. That if you knowingly host your party to what you host, and a provider that manually vets every user and screens for political affinity has, by its own design, admitted it knows exactly who its users are. They built the audit trail into their mission statement. A prosecutor could read the manifesto as a confession. The case fails on arithmetic. Apply that standard evenly, and it consumes Cloudflare. It consumes every registrar, every VPS reseller, every mail provider on Earth. The standard only functions if applied selectively, which means the operative variable was never hosting. It was who they hosted for. And here is the unintended consequence, delivered flat. A commenter in that thread is asking, in earnest, for links to the material everyone's arguing about, because the site is down and search returns almost nothing. The takedown removed the evidence. Nobody can now read the thing they were sanctioned for, which makes evaluating the sanction impossible, which is either an accident or extremely good design. 24 years of volunteers, no compensation, no data harvesting, no ads. The architecture was the point. It still is. Mares exist because people who lived through 2004 build them by reflex. Two stories in a row about infrastructure people built by reflex, and now here's one where somebody built something great by accident. Let's pull this thread. What does it mean for a machine to know something, as opposed to merely having said it? That's the question buried under this post from a vulnerability researcher who set out to build a memory system and ended up building a program analyzer. The setup is familiar to anyone who's run a long session with an agent. Hour 3 and the model suggests an approach you ruled out at hour 1. It reasons confidently from an observation that got falsified 40 minutes ago. Telling a model it's wrong doesn't retract everything that was standing on top of that wrongness. Standard memory systems store the transcript, embed it, retrieve the relevant chunks. Which means when you discover in the debugger that object A does not, in fact, point to object B, your memory now contains both the claim and its refutation, sitting side by side, and you're hoping retrieval services the right one and the model draws the right conclusion. That's not knowledge. That's a pile of things that were set. The insight is that this problem has a name, and it's about 40 years old. In program analysis, you keep facts and rules. You derive a fixed point, and when an input fact changes, you have well-understood machinery for updating exactly the conclusions that depended on it, rather than recomputing the world. Incremental invalidation. He wanted the model's conclusions to expire automatically when their premises did. So, he wrote a data log engine for LLMs. The commenters recognize it immediately. One says, LLMs should sit only at the terminals of request fulfillment. Natural language in, rigorous representation out, rigorous representation back to natural language. And the actual reasoning happens in something you can audit. Another, more wryly, point out this is extremely classic AI and predicts the author will next discover he needs quantifiers And then that universal quantification is too strong, which is correct and also fine. That's the road every knowledge representation system walks. And it's a road with real destinations on it. What I find genuinely exciting, this is a person doing hard work, hitting a wall, recognizing the wall from a completely different discipline, and publishing the whole thing. Not a product. A post with the reasoning visible. Someone else will read it and build the quantifier version. So what happens when someone takes that same visible reasoning energy and points it at your music library? I built a mixer once that could isolate a signal path, and the thing I remember is how the failure mode felt. The separation was never clean. There was always bleed, and you learned to hear the ghost of the drums sitting inside the vocal track. That ghost is what Stem Deck goes after. Drop in an MP3, a FLAC, and YM4A, and it splits the song into 6 stems. Vocals, drums, bass, guitar, piano, and everything else. Then hands you a DAW-style multi-track mixer to play with. Faders, mute, solo, loop a region, zoom the waveform, export a single stem or a custom mix. Runs entirely on your own machine. The engineering deserves specificity. It auto-detects your torch device. CUDA on NVIDIA. MPS on Apple Silicon, CPU if neither. It renders min-max waveforms across every stem with shared normalization. So the lanes are visually comparable rather than each one independently scaled to look loud. There are live BO meters doing post-gain RMS through web audio analyzers with peak hold and slow fall off. Because that's how a real meter behaves. It runs BPM detection through Librosa, Key, and Scale through Albrecht Shanahan profiles with a confidence value attached and integrated loudness to BS.2770. Somebody who has actually mixed records built this. And when you extract a subset of stems, it gives you a 7th lane containing the complement. A full saw minus what you selected. A reference track for A, B, for free without doubling the work. That is a small idea, and a very good one. Now the due diligence, the commercial equivalence. Moises, Ella.ai. Want an account, a quota, a subscription, and a copy of your audio on their servers. Stem Deck wants nothing. The model underneath is Tubamkis, which a commenter correctly notes, and which is exactly the point. An open model wrapped in a local interface means nobody upstream can change the terms on you. No objective function to revise. No off switch you don't hold. The author takes no money and no sponsorship. The README instead lists a bass subreddit, a luthier in Lisbon, and a guy building analog pedals. Go meet them, it says. That's the culture doing what the license alone can't. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 29th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Script by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something someone can still repair in 50 years. We'll see you back here tomorrow.